Good morning. Brad, what was the translation that you used?
The Anabaptist.
The Anabaptist. Sorry, I missed that part. The Common English Bible. It was lovely, really lovely. Thank you. My name is Lori Unger. I serve on the preaching team here at Tumsi, and I'm grateful to be with you this morning. Can you hear me? Okay, yeah. Yesterday, as I sat down to complete this sermon, wind and rain pummeled our little homestead. The forest, newly greened by the hot days and the sun before, was alive and churning. Trees trusting their roots to keep them tethered as branches swayed. Though in the night I heard a thud. I'll go later today to see which trees have fallen. This morning the forest was still, the songbirds were quiet, even the mosquitoes seemed unsure if it was safe to emerge. Pink petals from the prolific apple tree adorned the ground. In the early morning, a woodpecker ventured out from wherever it had been hiding to announce the new day. We moved fallen branches from the driveway as we drove. If a tree falls in the forest and no one is there to hear it, does it make a sound? This classic thought experiment, bandied about in the Western philosophical tradition since the late 1700s, is astonishingly obtuse. The answer obviously was no. No, it doesn't make a sound. The falling tree would have produced sound waves, but with no human ear available to receive the vibration, there would be no actual sound. Dilemma solved. The question is a variation on a theme that has preoccupied Western thinkers into the 20th century, and I would argue has shaped our own imagination. Einstein reportedly once asked a colleague, "Do you really believe that the moon only exists if you look at it?" These questions illustrate with shocking clarity the arrogance and the hubris of the Western imagination. Where do you need to be sitting in relation to the rest of the created order in order to presume to ask such a question? Above it, presumably, separate from it, and superior to it. We had this conversation last time. This time I'm prepared. I'm putting my glasses on, yes. And the real-time implications of this separation have been devastating. The Earth, modified for human comfort and commodified for our enrichment, the Earth dying as humans exult in our superiority. I recently read a book recommended by my son Ezra, who had read it as a part of the philosophy course he took at Canadian Mennonite University. The Pine Island Paradox, Making Connections in a Disconnected World by Kathleen Dean Moore. It's a book of narrative philosophy in which she recounts the experience of her family summering on an island off the coast of Alaska. Pine Island, a small northern Pacific island with a 15-foot tide and not another human soul, accessible only by boat from the mainland. As she describes her encounters with the natural world, she does the thinking around the question of environmental ethics. In it, she asks the questions, who am I in this time and place, and what ought I to do? How will I know what I ought to do? Well, with a 15-foot tide, you can imagine, the ocean will cover and uncover a remarkable landscape that is ocean in one moment and exposed seabed in the next. In one story, she tells about making her way with her daughter down to the caves, hidden most of the year and exposed only a few days when the tide is at its lowest. I'm going to read it to you because it's astonishing and poetic. So she's making her way down the dripping seabed that's just been exposed. Sea smell rose around us, salty and thick. In the dark, we listened intently. At first, all we heard was the sea itself, the soft inhale, the asthmatic, gurgling exhale. Then, gradually, spaces between the rocks began to tick and pop. Seaweed squeaked, scritching, moved in around us. Tiny claws and bubbling jaws behind us to our sides. There was the constant plop, plop, as salt water dripped off invisible globules and tentacles and God knows what else. The loudest sound was a steady tick by my right hand, but then something big breached the water and slapped back down. I heard Erin suck in her breath. Eyes, she announced, dozens of eyes. Startled, I looked into the water, nothing but darkness. No, hundreds, she said, swinging her headlamp beam across the bay. Hundreds of them, little yellow eyes like tiny cats around a campfire. I searched the black water. Turn on your headlamp, Erin commanded, standing up. The eyeballs bobbled at the base of long waving antennae, as ephemeral as dotted lines, and the antennae sprouted from the head of a shrimp. There they were, standing on their tiptoes on gravel, like little bent cylinders of pink striped skin around clear water, with beaded legs no thicker than whiskers, hundreds of shrimp all turned around us, staring into our lights. We'd been living our daylight lives on the surface of the island, thinking we were alone out there. If we thought about it at all, thinking we were in charge, never dreaming of the other worlds that came out at night. Enlightenment philosophers have mapped out, she says, such a miserable, lonely world for us to live in. For 400 years, we children of the Enlightenment have sat alone and damp-eyed in a world of nothing but stone and dumb brutes, the only spirit in a universe of matter and mechanical animal clocks, the only shining eyes in a universe stripped of mystery, exposed to human understanding and control, reduced to human convenience. Lonely kings of the stony mountain, we warily watch the world through our weak and narrow beams of light, denying the existence of everything we can't see. In this post-Easter season, we've been talking about creation care and considering the question, what does it mean to live faithfully in a world where humans have forgotten our place in the order of things? The poetry of Genesis 1 is astonishing. And it is poetry, isn't it? I invite you to read it and think of it as poetry. A scientific mind will notice that in this creation account, things are all out of order. Somehow day and night have come and gone three times already before the sun is created. The earth already flourishes with vegetation and plant life. Clearly, the order of things is incidental to this creation myth. Facts and figures aren't the work of the poet. I will read a little bit more of Genesis 1. I invite you to listen for repetition and emphasis. Allow the images to swirl in your imagination. Think of it through the lens of all of creation and not necessarily of humans at the pinnacle. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless void, and darkness covered the face of the earth while a wind from God swept over the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good. Verse 6, and God said, "Let there be a dome in the midst of the waters." Wait. There was evening and there was morning. That was the first day. And then God said, "Let there be a dome in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." And God called the dome sky, and there was evening and there was morning, the second day. Then God said, "Let the waters under the sky be gathered together in one place, and let the dry land appear." And God saw that it was good. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed of every kind and trees of every kind bearing fruit and seed in it. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the third day. Then God said, "Let there be lights in the dome of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and days and years." God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night and the stars. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the fourth day. Then God said, "Let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth and across the dome of the sky." And so there were great monsters and every living thing that moves, every kind, and the waters swarmed. God blessed them and said, "Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the waters with seeds, let the waters in the seas, and let birds multiply." And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures of every kind, cattle and creeping things and wild animals of the earth of every kind." And it was so. And God saw that it was good. And then God said, "Let's make humankind in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish in the sea, over the birds in the air, and the cattle, and over all the wild animals in the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." God blessed them and said, "Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth." God said, "See, I've given you every plant yielding seed that is upon the face of the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit, and you shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has breath of life, I have given every green plant for food." And it was so. God saw everything he had made, all of those things, and it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. There was a seventh day, and that was the day that God rested. Whew. Of course, God rested. If you consciously decenter a human being from that narrative, this creation account speaks different things. Like, humans aren't the only part of the created order that is told to have dominion. Did you notice? The sun rules the day. and the moon rules the night. Their dominion has nothing to do with exploitation and only giving. They aren't, humans aren't the only creatures told to be fruitful and multiply. I think I hadn't noticed that before. The creatures of the sea and sky are also instructed to fill the earth. And did you notice the food of the earth isn't created just for the benefit of humans, but for the benefit of every living thing? And not just like it's, you always notice what's important to a poet by what they spend time on. I mean, it's every living thing at length. You might expect if the poet intended to center humans that God would have created and declared them right away very good. But he doesn't. I assume it's a he. It's only after the whole of creation is finished that God finally expresses God's satisfied pleasure. There's an arrogance in thinking that because God made us last, God must have made us best. That we are somehow disconnected from and superior to the created world around us. This disconnection is actually embedded in our language. According to Robin Wall Kimmerer, who wrote Braiding Sweetgrass, in Ojibwe, the language of animacy, that means according, I guess, dignity to living things, or awareness, or personhood, extends to plants, animals, rocks, mountains, water, fire, and places, medicines, songs, drums, even stories. All are animate. The list of inanimate things seems to be smaller, filled with objects that are made by people. Of an inanimate being, like a table, we say, "What is it?" And we answer, "Table, it is." Dapwen yewe. But of an apple, we must say, "Who is that being?" And we answer, "Dapwen yewe." Nope. We answer, "Mshimmin yewe." Apple, that being is. How different than English. So I think it's fair to say, when we are considering how best to proceed faithfully as stewards of the earth, that our first responsibility is simply to notice that we are in relation, meaningful relation, to all other created beings. Secondly, I think we need to move away from our despair. I'm going to say that again. I think we need to move away from our despair. When we are despairing, we feel helpless, like nothing we could ever do could ever have an impact on the world around us. But in saying so, we forget that every choice we make already has an impact on the world around us. It's not possible to not have an impact on the world around us. Every choice we make impacts the world around us. And so when we say, we despair and say, "What can we do?" There's nothing to do. We are subscribing to that narrative that somehow we are separate. We are not separate. We are not disconnected, even if we might even wish to think so. C.S. See, that's what happens when I go off script. Then I have to look again. Robin Wall Kimmerer reminds us that every being has a gift. A bird's gift, for example, is to glitter, she says, and to sing the morning into being. It is understood that a gift is also a responsibility. If the bird's gift is song, then it has a responsibility to greet the day with music. It is the duty of birds to sing, and for the rest of us to receive the song as a gift. Asking what is our responsibility is perhaps also to ask, what is our gift, and how shall we use it? Kimmerer says, our gift is our words. With God, we can speak the world into being. We can engage our creative imagination and speak our dreams into being. That is our gift. But before we do that, we have to step into our place. We have to remember that we are not above, beyond, separate from. We're in the middle of it. And so we can cooperate with the world to call into our mutual well-being. And we're not alone. See, this is the thing. The thing about remembering that we're not separate and that our actions resonate in the world is that the world, the earth, is ready to participate with us. Here's some things that I learned this week. Mushrooms can dissolve plastic. What if we could cultivate mushrooms to help us clean up our mess? That's really cool. Tobacco takes toxins out of the earth. Like, it'll just suck them out if you plant it. Same with cattails. The earth is waiting for us to notice its gifts. The earth is waiting for us to notice and then begin to cooperate, to have our big ideas and then speak them into being. How cool is that? Last week, Dora was building some rabbit cages, and she punctured her leg with metal, and it swelled up. Like, it got hot and puffy. I mean, what's the option when you get stuck with metal and your leg swells up and gets hot and puffy? That's an infection, right? So you go to the doctor, and the doctor gives you something that comes in a tube, or maybe some antibiotics. I had just learned about the properties of mullein. Do you know about mullein? It's a fuzzy little leaf. It grows all over. I just went and got it from the garden and chopped it up and put a poultice on her leg. Do you know what mullein does? It sucks poison out of you. You just put it on there. She had it on for about 2 hours, and the redness went away. It takes attentiveness and learning and remembering. Do you know our ancestors knew all these things? It takes some remembering and some quiet presence together with the created world to remember how the created order is going to work with us to bring together something else. Yeah. Kathleen Dean Moore, in this book, relates a conversation with a Powhatan Penpe writer, Jack Forbes. That's an indigenous community and nation in the New Jersey area, Pennsylvania. He said, You know, you could take out my eyes and I would still live on. Cut off my ears, my nose, cut off my legs and I could still live. But take away the air and I die. Take away the sun and I die. Take away the plants and the animals and I die. So why would I think that my body is more a part of me than the sun and the earth? Dean Moore, still down in the tidal cave, imagines a conversation with one of those Enlightenment thinkers who duped the Western world into thinking we were somehow alone in the created order. Here, she imagines she would say, stick your finger into this anemone and feel it shrink away from you. Reach into the water and try to touch those waving tentacles at the mouth of the tube. See them snap away? Reach out to touch the sculpin. Look how it disappears in a puff of sand. Turn off your headlamp. All the eyes will vanish. Move once, just wave one arm, and every sound will stop. And you'll be sitting in a world that is froid, sombre, muet et vide. Maybe he'd look up, startled. And you, she would continue, doubting the truth of anything you can't see clearly and distinctly. Something, doubting the existence of anything you can't perceive, will believe that the world is in fact cold, dark, silent, and empty. But if you sit still in the dark, breathing quietly, the world will come to life around you. Astonishment will rise in you like the slow tide, sliding in and under the soles of your feet. And then you will understand you are kin in a family of living things, aware in a world of awareness, alive in a world of lives, breathing as the shrimp breathe, as the kelp breathes, as the water breathes, as the alders breathe. The slow in and out. So if a tree falls in the forest and no one is around to hear it, does it still make a sound? Of course it does. Did you know that mushrooms grow to vibration? Mushrooms would also grow to the sound of community, our community, children running on the earth. Let us join with all creation to become a part of it, so that we know what to do next.